Hello and welcome to Politico's 2016 Nerdcast, where we bring you the stories behind the stories and geek out on this amazing circus of an election. It's Thursday, July 28th, and I'm Kristen Roberts, National Editor. This week, we're coming to you from the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, and here are the numbers that mattered. 269 to 269, the perfectly plausible Electoral College split that leads to a tiebreaker in the House. 30,000, the number of Hillary Clinton's deleted emails that Donald Trump would like Vladimir Putin to unearth. 0.56%, the share of a $142 million pot of gold that state Democratic parties got from the Clinton fundraising agreement. And 44, the number of minutes that Barack Obama spent taking down Trump and creating an avenue for Hillary. Grab your calculators and enjoy the 2016 Nerdcast. Hello to my Philly crew, Ken Vogel.
Yo.
Hadass Gold.
Hi.
And senior politics editor, Charlie Mattesian.
Yo.
So we've had another great week of questions from our listeners. Let's take one from Jeffrey out on the West Coast. Hello out there, Jeffrey. What's your question?
Hi, guys. So I'm trying to figure out whether I'm more baffled by or more terrified by Trump's surge in the polls that was reported earlier this week, even after his flaming tire and or garbage fire of a convention last week. For now, this information has been more baffling to me because while Romney lost in 2012 because he only won with white voters, these recent polls suggest that Trump is surging despite absolutely no indication that he's even attempting to reach outside that same group of white voters. So what gives? Should we just toss out our math-informed understanding of voter demographics from 2012 as a relic of a less insane time and one that has no application to the 2016 election? In other words, should I be less baffled and more terrified?
Charlie?
I think it's a great question, and it's one that I've heard a lot of people voice because, you know, when you drill down into the numbers, when you talk to folks, you realize that Donald Trump has some serious problems with some significant demographics, whether you're talking about Hispanics or college-educated women, African-Americans. I mean, you can just go down the list. So how is he even close is the question that at least I often hear. And I think if you boil things down, here's what's going on. Broadly speaking, in recent presidential elections, the Republican nominee typically carries about 6 out of 10 white voters. Romney, for example, won 59%. That was up from 55% for McCain. George W. Bush won 58% of white voters. But the problem here that Republicans have is that white voters are a declining share of the electorate, and so they have a conundrum. What we're seeing this year, though, and I think the big difference is the difference-making contingent or demographic group is white voters without a college degree. And so basically we're talking about less educated white voters, and they are going for Donald Trump in bigger numbers than we've seen in the past. In fact, by huge numbers. I recently saw a CNN poll, for example, and I think it's the most recent one, where Trump had actually expanded his lead with those voters, you know, white voters who don't hold a college degree. He was up 51 to 31, 20 points. Now his lead is 62 to 23. That's 39. So he's gone from 20 points to 39 points. And that is just a huge gap. And I think it accounts for some of why he's doing well, because white voters without a college degree is a fairly big slice of the electorate.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Charlie. And Jeffrey, thanks for your question.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the answer.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Bye. Bye. Let's get to some data points. Charlie suggests 269 to 269. Let's look at the prospects of an electoral college tie coming out of 2 weeks of conventions, looking at a general election in which, frankly, this nation is divided 50-50 if you are to believe the polls. Tell me, Charlie, what would happen if the election day result is a tie?
Well, when you see a race this close, you know, you begin to start seeing the stories and the discussions about what happens in the worst case horrible scenario where we end up at 269 to 269. And that might seem like it's a prospect that could never happen, but in fact it's happened twice in American history, not recently. It happened in the 18th century. But if you play around with the maps and the electoral votes, you can get to a plausible 269 to 269 tie. There are actually several ways to get there, and the New York Times Upshot did a nice map the other day of a totally plausible 269 to 269 scenario. And what's remarkable about that is, I mean, think about how polarized we are right now as a nation, and think about if we ran into that kind of situation where we were dead tied between Godzilla and King Kong, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
Which is which?
I don't want to touch that one. But if you're, you know, and you can build out your own map. There are sites that do it. 270towin.com, for example, is a very good one. And you can find a number of different combinations that'll get you there. And what I find most fascinating about it, at least sort of gaming it out and speculating about, is what would happen next. Because if there is a tie, it gets thrown to the House of Representatives. And so can you imagine? Can you imagine the kind of rancor that we would see if that was the case? Because the House would suddenly be the locus of all kinds of bitterness, even more bitterness than right now. And then you have the prospect of in the House, when they vote, it's by state delegation. It's not individual members. And so all of a sudden you add an additional layer of complexity to the whole situation. And it's just a mess in the making if that happens.
I mean, if we're playing the hypothetical game, first of all, in that instance, you would have the Senate electing the vice president. So maybe some deal making, say, if Democrats take the Senate and you have a divided legislature, one chamber and one party, one chamber and the other, possible
Clinton
striking
Pence.
Of a deal, right? Something like that. Or like Kane Pence or Pence Kane, you know. But to take the hypothetical even further, what if you have a situation where it's like a 2000 situation where one state and there's a contest over one state that is gridlocked and it goes to the Supreme Court, which is tied 4-4. Then you got to wait for one of the justices to die, and then you'd have another president.
What happens in that situation where there's no president who is in charge, like while they're deciding all this?
You would have
the current president.
Obama would just stay.
Yeah.
So Sarah Silverman would get her wish. This is the comedian who supported Bernie and then reluctantly came on and supported Hillary and actually appeared at the convention to kind of shame some of the Bernie dead enders. But last night during President Obama's speech, she tweeted, "Go Barry, 4 more years." And in fact, I heard other people screaming in the hall, 4 more years and don't leave us.
And so, best president ever. There
right.
was a lot of shouting on the
a
floor last
night. A
lot
of Obama love, so those folks would get their wish in this hypothetical.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think it reminds us that this would make Gore versus Bush look like patty cake.
I mean, that's extraordinary. I can't even imagine that, actually. But it has been, what, 200 years since the House decided an election?
Yeah, 1824 was the last time.
It was Quincy Jackson, right?
So we're due.
How do I
Quincy
know
Adams. That's not bad, though. Damn.
I know. I'm pretty smart. I know. You're not just pretty and smart. I'm pretty and smart, too. Let's talk about another number. It's 30,000. I love this one. Hadass suggested it. It's the number of Hillary Clinton emails that Donald Trump would like Vladimir Putin to find for him. This was an extraordinary moment this week when Trump went public with his desire for a foreign government to hack into his opposition's email. The rebuke was swift. It was bipartisan.
Including even somewhat from within his own campaign.
Yeah, tell me about the story.
Well, I mean, so Donald Trump held that press conference in Florida. And from what I understand, this press conference is actually almost what's the compensation for all the reporters who had trudged down there because they had come down there. Supposed to be some kind of Hispanic meeting, and that didn't work out. And so he holds this big press conference trying, you know, wrest the news cycle away from Hillary Clinton's convention. He very successfully does that, but maybe slightly to his detriment, although at this point, who knows what's to Trump's detriment and what's not. And in it, he was talking about the DNC hack and Hillary Clinton's emails, and he said that he would like for Russia to please go ahead, and it would be really nice if they could go find it. Now, his team is trying to parse words and say, oh, he wasn't calling them to hack it. He was just saying if they already have it, they should give it to the FBI. You know, there was so much spinning that
right, and he wasn't saying that Barack Obama wasn't an American. It was other people.
Right.
Who were
I mean,
saying
it's a classic Trump thing. It's so much spin that the Olympics next month are going to seem like nothing.
But I mean, it's really, you can parse it any way you want, but I thought actually Ashley Parker in the New York Times did a good job characterizing this, you know, rather starkly in her lead, saying that what he was doing was essentially urging a foreign adversary to conduct cyber espionage against a former Secretary of State. And that's what he was doing, no matter how he spun it. And that really, as you suggested, was extraordinary and drew rebukes within his own party, even on his own ticket almost. Mike Pence distanced himself from it. And I think that was a really interesting moment. I think we could end up seeing quite a bit more of that if Trump continues to sort of speak extemporaneously and say some of this outrageous stuff, which is so anathema to like everything that Pence has done in his political career, which has been sort of more careful and thoughtful. Even if you don't like some of the places that he has gone, he's done it deliberatively. That's the opposite of Trump.
Yeah, and this is going to be something that keeps up coming, and I was just thinking what all of these members of Congress who are going to be approached by reporters constantly saying, do you support Russia pretty much hacking, the presidential nominee encouraging another country to hack into our system? But here's the thing, you know, his supporters, I don't know if they care. I mean, I think that they see Hillary Clinton as such an awful person. I mean, they chant lock her up all the time, that I think they say, you know, in their minds, anything that's necessary to get her out and to make her lose.
This is really an important point that you're making here, Hadass. This might be, from Washington's perspective, one of the biggest mistakes that Donald Trump has made. And he's made a lot of what we would consider mistakes. But it's now baked into his brand. He's the guy who says anything and nothing sticks. And, you know, we're talking about a general election with, if Hillary Clinton had said that, the story would be completely different. She would be tumbling in the polls. People would be vicious in their takedowns of her on both sides. Donald Trump says it, and we're just numb to it almost. Now, this one might be a little bit different. You saw how quickly Paul Ryan came out and said, Russia needs to stay out of American politics. But does the public care? I think your point is exactly the right one to make, Hadass.
No, and I don't think they care. And I think the only thing that we've actually seen that has stuck, and I reported on this a couple months ago, that in the focus groups, the most negative thing for Donald Trump was the Serge Kovalevsky imitation of the disabled reporter. And we have seen Hillary Clinton and the Democrats use this a lot this week. They did a whole night where they really featured Hillary Clinton's work and the Democrats' work on the ADA. They showed videos about this. And Donald Trump still to this day has to come back and say, I wasn't making fun of him. I don't know him, blah, blah, blah. That seems to be one of the few things that in all of his comments about Mexicans, Muslims, all of that stuff, it is the potential mocking of a disabled reporter. It's the only thing that seems to stick, even more so than encouraging another country to commit, you know, cyber espionage on us.
If you go to the Merriam-Webster dictionary website right now, it's Merriam-Webster.com. They list the most searched words. The first one right now is malarkey, which was taken from Joe Biden's speech last night. But number three is the word treason. I mean, treason is a word we don't throw around very lightly. We rarely even use it. And clearly, a lot of people don't even know what it means. It's almost, you know, has these 19th or 18th century connotations. And the idea that that word is being bandied about and that people are reacting to what his statement and referring to it as treason really goes to show you just how politically radioactive that statement was and just how much damage it could cause to his campaign.
And to Kristen's point about the, you know, to some extent, like double standard, the way that we deal with his outrageous statements versus Clinton's more measured statements, but sometimes, you know, careless behavior, in the words of the FBI. I mean, Hillary has been accused of treason through, you know, many times over the past, year or years. And it's interesting to see behavior that probably comes closer to the actual definition, drawing sort of mixed reactions.
What was the effect, Hadass, in the media? This story hit, what was it, on Tuesday? The story hit on Tuesday?
Wasn't it yesterday?
Oh my gosh, I totally lost control. I have no idea what the days of the week are after 2 weeks of a convention. So the story hit yesterday. What was the coverage of it? What did the DNC get as much coverage? Did they lose coverage because of this? What was that balance like?
I think during those hours during the day, it was all Donald Trump, 100%. And, you know, I was watching the cable news coverage, and it was as though there was no Democratic convention going on. It was because it was just so explosive. By the evening, that had switched, obviously, once you had this lineup of, you know, Biden and Obama and all of that. And everybody on TV was mentioning that contrast. They were saying, you know, this is such a different seen what we saw tonight versus what we saw this morning with Donald Trump. What was also really interesting and what I was watching is how people's headlines changed because of the pushback against whether he was calling them to hack or quote-unquote find, you know, miraculously come upon some emails and release them, or whether they already had them. The New York Times, for example, their breaking news alert said that Donald Trump had called on Russia to hack Hillary Clinton, and then within half an hour, their online headline had changed just to say, you know, Donald Trump encourages Russia to find more emails or something like that.
There's also a really stark contrast, and I think the news coverage reflects this, between the conventions. I mean, this convention here in Philadelphia, the Democrats, is such a smoothly choreographed affair. Obviously, the Sanders people raised a ruckus and stole the narrative for at least parts of different news cycles, but the convention itself went off really smoothly and was a slickly produced affair, versus on the other side with the Ted Cruz non-endorsement, just blowing things up. I mean, plagiarized speeches. And so, to some extent, Democrats, they lose some bandwidth in the media because it's all going as expected. And the only time that they get a little bit of explosive coverage is over the Sanders stuff. So the GOP convention, I think, dominated the headlines much more, both because the guy who could potentially steal the headlines, Trump, was a part of it, and because there were all these sort of unchoreographed plot lines. And this week, not so much. So it allows someone like Trump, to come in and steal the news cycle.
The explosiveness of the issue was real to me, at least, in the responses, because as everybody here knows, in this modern era, in the way politics operates right now, almost every response is canned, prefabricated, taken off the shelf, and it's just like ping pong, all these news events. Where I find huge news, the thing that indicates to me it's going to be huge news, is when no one has a response immediately. And right out of the gate, after that statement was made, there was no response. There was quiet because no one knew how to react, and Democrats had to sit down and get in a room and figure out, wow. And this was true of the Clinton campaign as well. They had to take some time to figure out, how do you respond to something like this? And that's always an indicator of a grave incident or something that's really big. So big that it was unexpected and no one even has a planned response.
All right, let's get to another data point. 0.5%, that's how much state Democratic parties got to keep of the $142 million raised with Hillary Clinton's joint fundraising committee. Ken, what is going on here?
Yeah, we looked at the FEC filings and found that this joint fundraising committee, the Hillary Victory Fund, was raising a ton of money. It's sort of one of the strengths of her finance operation. And it was able to raise all this money because it included so many state parties. At one point, there were 32 of the state parties were members of this. Now it's up to 40. Well, what that means is that they can accept a larger check because they, within the sort of contribution limit of this bigger committee, have all the contribution limits of the state parties, $10,000 each. So they're able to accept these huge checks, hundreds of thousands of dollars from major donors, but they're supposed to transfer it out to the participating committees, which include all these state parties. Well, they were doing that, but then almost immediately we found this money was being sent from the state parties to the DNC. So it was really essentially helping Hillary and Hillary's allies at the DNC subsidize their operation as opposed to helping these state parties. Now, the reason why this is important is because Clinton sort of justified the big checks that she was raising at, really extravagant fundraisers like at George Clooney's house, for instance, by saying, oh, no, it's not for me, it's for the state parties. FEC records suggest otherwise. And when we revealed this initially back in May, this infuriated not just some of the state party folks who thought that they were going to get more money. It also infuriated campaign finance watchdogs who thought that it was a way for the party and the campaign to circumvent contribution limits. And it really pissed off Bernie Sanders' allies because they thought that this was yet another way that the DNC sort of had its thumb on the scale for Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders during their contested primary.
I think it was just one more piece of evidence that Bernie Sanders was right. The DNC was totally, completely, madly, deeply in the tank for Hillary Clinton during the campaign. And ultimately, we see from the WikiLeaks that he was right, and it, you know, ultimately cost Debbie Wasserman Schultz her job. You know, it's pretty fascinating when you think about it, the way she sort of dismissed Bernie Sanders and didn't think very highly of him or his operation. And I can't help but wonder, you know, how what their relationship was like in the House together. You know, there wasn't a ton of overlap, but you can almost imagine that somebody like DWS didn't really think very highly or didn't have any time for somebody like Bernie Sanders, who was dismissed by many in Washington as sort of this irrelevant backbencher who was just sort of off, you know, complaining about different things. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz was this up-and-coming rising star who had no time for Bernie Sanders' long-shot campaign, and ultimately it caused her downfall.
And in some ways, he really got the last laugh. I mean, the Sanders folks who I talked to on background were like really tickled by this. They were pleased. I mean, first of all, the WikiLeaks in particular shows the hypersensitivity of the DNC and of the Clinton campaign to this perception, but it also proves that there was something there.
That they wasn't just a perception.
Right, that it wasn't just a perception. And so that for them, this was sort of an aha moment where they were able to point to this stuff, and it wasn't just about, you know, planting bad stories about Bernie Sanders and questioning whether they should, you know, invoke his atheism or his level of observance as a Jew. I mean, they had an extensive back and forth, the DNC and the Clinton campaign and their lawyers, about this very topic, about the Joint Fundraising Committee and about our stories on the Joint Fundraising Committee and how they should approach our stories and how they should spin other reporters seeking to follow our stories. It actually it got so bad, there was an interesting nugget. After we first wrote about this back in May, the DNC wanted to rebut it, and so they were looking for state party chairs who they could potentially put on a Sunday show to shoot down our story and say, no, we're very pleased with our participation in the Joint Fundraising Committee, even though we're not getting a lot of money in our actual bank account. And they proposed the Indiana state chair, one of the DNC staffers did. But then another DNC staffer said, well, how do we know this isn't one of the people who is secretly upset about this and complaining off the record to Politico if we get him on TV and he's spouting the line in the Politico story as opposed to our line? It would look really bad.
Oh, God, what a cluster.
Here's another number, 44. That's how many minutes the 44th president of the United States spoke during the Democratic National Convention. Hadass, how did Barack Obama's speech play?
I think Obama's speech came off very well. I heard a lot of people this morning calling it one of his top five speeches of his political career, in addition to the 2004 Democratic National Convention speech, which really put him on the map, as well as his speech after the Sandy Hook tragedy. And, you know, it was classic Obama. He was clearly energized. He clearly was taking the moment to try to really contrast the Democrats and Hillary Clinton to Donald Trump and what Donald Trump stands for. And you could tell there was a lot of urgency, I think, in his voice. Although I would like to say that he, some people were criticizing him for suggesting that, you know, almost acting in a way that, like, Donald Trump does not represent America, he's not going to win. Some Democrats I spoke to were kind of hoping that he would really, really put the sense of urgency in that, like, this could spell the end of the world, don't let that happen. And Obama took the much more positive, happy route.
What do you think, Charlie?
I thought it was pretty terrific. I think it will go down as one of his best speeches ever, as Hadass mentioned, not quite at the elevation of the 2004 speech, but pretty high up there. And what was really striking about it to me was something that I mentioned to you earlier this morning, Kristen, which was I loved the distillation of American values. And what I mean by that is that what he was saying about American values would have been right in place with the founding fathers, the way they talked about this country. Or the country they envisioned. And it was also really forward-looking because it was almost like a 21st century expression of those values as reimagined these days.
Well, he also was taking what sounded like Republican statements and like lines that you would have normally heard in a Republican speech, but it was at the Democratic speech. He quoted Reagan, and Donald Trump did not quote Reagan. You could tell that he was kind of giving a signal to those Republicans who might be super wary of Donald Trump and say, hey, we're not so bad.
It was more than a signal. I mean, at the beginning of the speech, he said, you know, this guy is not a conservative.
Right.
And you could hear conservatives around the country, you could hear them saying, he's right about that. Yeah. I mean, one of the most interesting things that I saw on the second screen experience was Eric Erickson tweeting, you know, I started today thinking Donald Trump might win, and then I just watched this speech, and I can't tell you how angry I am at my party, right? Look, Barack Obama is a great speech giver, and the Democrats in the audience and around the country just ate it up. They loved it. But I think your point, Hadass, at the start of this was exactly the right one. Like, he had a message for Democrats, and he tried to have a message for Republicans, but the truth is, like, the vision of the current state of the United States of America is not shared uniformly by Americans.
I thought the Reagan analogy that Hadass made was really apt here, because I thought of Ronald Reagan a lot as I watched that speech last night, and I don't often think that they share a lot in common. When you look, Reagan is one of my famous or favorite speech givers. If you look at some of his most famous work, whether it's A Time for Choosing or his challenge speech at the 1976 convention, he is just fantastic. The guy just explodes off the screen. He's that good. And for a time, as I watched Obama last night, he really reminded me of some of those qualities. And it may have been the way he expressed his vision of America, because that's what's always leaped out about Ronald Reagan to me, the way he expressed his feelings about America and the way that he expressed his commitment to Republican ideals. And I felt that I got a real vibe of that from Obama last night.
Yeah, but you also thought he was snarky.
I did think he was a little too snarky. I think there's a real danger for Democrats, particularly in an election where Donald Trump's path to victory is with white working class or white working class voters who don't have college education. There's a real danger to taking this high, we're the Democrats, we're highly educated, we have tons of credentials from good schools, and we're here to save you from your stupidity argument. Like, that is deadly for the Democratic Party. And I think there were some elements of that in what he was saying. I thought it was clever, the line about Donald Trump's not a plan guy, he's also not a facts guy. It was funny. But once you take that too far, then you begin to demean an entire class of voters that already feels really cynical, really frustrated, and really feels like the system is rigged against them.
At the same time, though, I remember comparing the ends of both speeches of Trump's speech and Obama's speech, and I bet they did this on purpose. Trump's speech was a lot of I's. It was, I will make, you know, America
safe
point. Again. And I was reading this like late last night, and then Obama was a lot of you, like, you make America great, you do this. And also just like, this is a small thing.
There was a lot of we's, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, a lot of we's. I mean, Trump also used a lot of we's, but it was a lot more of like, I am the one, you know, which Obama mentioned, saying like, you know, this America is not a place where one savior comes and, you know, fixes everything. We do it all together. And one thing I also noticed, which is just, I think, very indicative of how different this is. We all talked about how at the RNC, you know, Trump never mentioned abortion or Israel or like things like that, that, you know, people are used to hearing in Republican speeches. Obama ended his speech with the God bless America, God bless everybody. Donald Trump didn't mention God at all at the end of the speech.
Yeah, but Democrats opened their convention with not a single American flag on the stage.
That is very true.
All right, final segment. What was your favorite convention moment, Hadass?
These conventions are like, it feels like summer camp / your like youth group conventions you would go to when you were growing up. Everybody's here. You can like grab sources left and right.
The hell are you talking about? Youth group events? What is this?
Well, when I was in high school, I was in a youth group. We'd do like these national conventions where it'd be like 3,000 teenagers in the convention hall. I was one of those. But, I think there's been like the fun ones. Like last night, I went to Pat's and Gino's at like 3 a.m. and Josh Gad from Book of Mormon was there, as was Congressman Payne from New Jersey was there as well. Everybody was together along with the drunkards getting cheesesteaks, which was cool. But probably one of my favorite moments reporting wise was as a media reporter, I don't usually get to do stakeouts like some of my colleagues do on the Hill or you know. Presidential campaigns running around, so much of my reporting is done over the phone, over email, over Twitter direct messaging. But when the Fox stuff broke, I camped out in front of the Fox News workspace in the RNC Convention Media Filing Center and was just catching people as they were walking in and out. And it was exciting, and getting told by security that we weren't allowed to be there, and they were trying to kick us out, trying to tell us we weren't allowed to talk to Fox employees, and we got to push back and be like, who says, you know, this is a filing center, we're all allowed to be, we're all reporters. And then getting to work with my team, I was catching their quotes, saving them in my phone, and just emailing them to the team up in New York who was transcribing them and writing them so that we were the first ones to have a lot of these reactions. So that was really cool.
Awesome. Charlie.
I would say I have two that are probably tied as favorite moments. One of them is like Hadassah's moment, actually at Pat's States. Now, as you guys know, I'm a Philadelphian born here. And as a kid, one of the highlights, one of my favorite things ever was going to Phillies games or Eagles games and going with my father late at night when the games would be over and going to Pat's or Gino's and getting a cheesesteak. I mean, it was the greatest thing ever. It was like Christmas night. And so it was really neat to go with, I don't know if you guys know this, you know, Kristen and I went there together when we did the little Nerdcast video, the 2-minute video. We went there one morning and filmed it eating a cheesesteak, and Kristen actually had her first cheesesteak and had to concede that it was excellent. It was a delicacy. And
it's not a fairy tale. Those things are good.
They are fantastic.
Wait, did you guys do Pat's or Gino's?
Pat's.
We went to Pat's. Mm-hmm. Although Gino's is really outstanding.
It was 10:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
Eating cheesesteak.
I would have tried them both, to be honest. The other favorite moment is, and this is maybe a little cheesy, a little corny, but like I've been to a bunch of conventions. I've been...
Whiz.
Whiz, provolone. I've been to a bunch of conventions, and one thing that I love is it makes me feel great to be an American, to be in the line. The security lines obviously suck. You know, you're getting wanded, and you're sweating, and like it takes an hour to get in. But it's so cool to be around the delegates, how excited they are going into the arena at night. You know, they're dressed in all sorts of crazy outfits, and not all of them, you know, some
it's
of them.
It's a political Comic-Con.
Yeah, it is. But they're so excited about it, and it just reminds me of how important politics can be and how meaningful it is in so many people's lives, and I really respect a lot of them. You know, they're shelling out a lot of money, taking a lot of time out of their lives because they're committed to a cause, and this is true on the Republican and Democratic side, and I love seeing that. It always makes me feel good about America. You know, I mean, you guys know, I'm really sappy about that kind of stuff. I love the flag. If I could, I'd wear these colors don't run T-shirt.
Why you
know?
Don't you? Why do you wear it all the time?
Yeah, I'm sure I have like a cutoff version of it. You know, cutoff sleeve at home. But like I love that sort of stuff. And
show
so
guns,
yeah,
bro.
I know gun show. But no, it's really exciting to be in that line around those people and the sort of vibe that you get going into the convention.
Ken.
Well, my favorite moment is not really a moment. It's sort of like a dynamic that you get to experience as a journalist covering these conventions with your colleagues. And Politico, obviously, devoting a lot of firepower, bringing a lot of journalists to both conventions, and being able to sort of work as a team with my colleagues. You know, we like fan out all over the floor during the big speeches and are like sending each other nuggets about like protesters or what people are chanting or what delegation is raising a ruckus because they felt Bernie didn't get his due or who's raising the TPP stuff. That sort of camaraderie, I think, is really motivating. And as far as like non like sideline stuff that isn't actually at the convention, I had the chance after staking out a big donor reception in Center City to swing by Scheib Vintage Sports. I too am a diehard Philadelphia fan, Philadelphia born and bred, and this place, Scheib Vintage Sports at 137 South 13th Street, just amazing like vintage Philadelphia Phillies hats and like cool like throwback shirts and whatnot. And I spent $120 there and probably could have spent like $230 if I didn't have to get on a bus back to the arena to cover the night's events.
I spent $80 at Scheib Sports. It is fantastic.
I spent no dollars at Scheib Sports.
Huge mistake, Kristen. Huge.
I don't know what my favorite part is. I feel sappy. I feel I agree with all the things that Ken said about our team. I think we've done extremely well these last 2 weeks, both in Cleveland and in here. I love the story of Grayson coming to the Politico newsroom here and being stunned that we were going to ask him a question. I thought that was brilliant. Maybe my favorite personal moment is our colleague Shane Goldmacher taking pity upon me, looking at me and realizing I hadn't properly eaten in a very long time and going and finding me some vegetables. So
vegetables.
I was really hungry for vegetables. There's only so much
here.
Cheese Whiz you can eat. Right? I'm kind of a small human. All right, that's it for us. Time to say goodbye. Say goodbye, Ken.
Hey, fun time as always.
Hadas.
Bye, Philly.
Charlie.
Bye, Christy.
Thank you for listening. See you next week.